It's time now for our ongoing series discussing substance use disorder as a treatable disease, brought to you by the Grays Harbor Consortium. We have with us
Colleen Chapin. I work as a substance use professional, a substance use dependence professional. Oh, I'm sorry, that's substance use disorder professional. They've changed our acronym so many times.
That always happens, yeah. And where are you based out of?
Right now I'm working at, Community Integrated Health Services in Aberdeen, Washington.
They changed that name on you too, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, but you're here in Aberdeen.
Yes, I am.
Okay. We are here to talk about substance use as in a treatable disease, and we're talking about abstinence-based versus harm reduction. What is abstinence-based, and what is harm reduction? So let's start with the abstinence-based.
Okay, so abstinence-based, and I'm not claiming to be an expert here, but I've been in the field for a couple of decades.
That qualifies you. Go ahead.
Okay, so abstinence-based is where you're looking at someone who's in recovery from substance use that is no longer using any substances. They're going about it through either a spiritual program or a behavioral program where they're changing their behaviors and there's no medication-assisted process within their abstinence-based program.
So abstinence-based, I'm a heroin addict.
Right.
Recovering. And I don't do anything to help me out. I don't take any of the medications that are out there to help me out or anything. I'm just avoiding everything.
That's typically what abstinence-based treatment looks like.
Mm-hmm. And what about harm reduction?
Harm reduction can be, there's also a way to look at harm reduction as medication-assisted treatment, although, you know, it's kind of a philosophical point of view as to whether people who are taking, like Suboxone, for instance, for heroin addiction, that's an anti-craving medication, fabulous medication that helps people get their lives back. You know, there's personal opinion and there's other people's opinions or other systems' opinions, but I believe when people are using medication as prescribed with a physician and they're working their recovery out in a variety of ways, that is abstinence-based. There's other people that come in maybe as a low barrier where they're not required to do any kind of treatment, they're not required to do anything but take the medication. That's more of a harm reduction model with that.
Medication. Is one better than the other?
One?
I mean, or does it depend upon the person?
You know, you can end up starting out on harm reduction and then end up being abstinence-based.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
You can progress from being on a harm reduction model to, you know, getting to where you want more for your recovery. And you want to, you know, either be tapered off those medications or maybe that medication is at a therapeutic level and it doesn't interfere with any aspect of your life. I mean, there's healthcare providers that are on Suboxone, you know, long term that, mm-hmm. you know, surgeons, doctors that are on Suboxone as a part of their recovery. And I wouldn't consider them not abstinent. They are living their lives and living their lives fully, but on a medication that helps with craving.
And that brings down the craving so they can actually function throughout life.
Right.
There are some people that say that doing a little bit of the substance every day, there are many people out there who are productive in society, if you will, and still addicted to a substance. And I'm just going to throw heroin out there because I read an article years ago about a bunch of people on Wall Street that function every day, but every morning they get up and take their shot of heroin.
Yeah, I haven't looked at that research.
Well,
I don't know their story. But
I don't know if it was research, but it was just an article that I read about that.
Yeah, and there are some folks who can use a substance and or abuse a substance and not have the negative effects that some other folks have when they become addicted to a substance.
Mm-hmm. Now, and this was not a positive article for these people. It was just showing how they need the substance to actually function throughout the day. Is there any difference between that and the medication that you're talking about?
Well, you usually get heroin by way of, you know, the streets. It's an illegal and you don't know what's in it. So it contains things that maybe you think you're getting heroin, but you might be getting heroin and something else.
Mm-hmm.
You might be getting fentanyl in it,
well,
which is really dangerous.
That's the real danger right now is the fentanyl,
yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah. And I guess that's getting into heroin and methamphetamines and other substances, too.
Right.
And if you are addicted and you're taking that stuff, you don't know you're getting the fentanyl.
Right. You're getting your stuff.
Yeah.
And you're not really checking it. Nobody's checking it out.
Well,
right.
It doesn't go through the FDA or anything.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, you don't know what you're getting when you do that.
Exactly.
Harm reduction with the medication. And you say there's many people out there who, do they do that pretty much their lives, take the medication to curb the cravings, if you will?
Well, Suboxone's been, or buprenorphine, same thing, Suboxone, mm-hmm. buprenorphine, has been out since the FDA approved it in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have, not too much research on how that may be a lifetime medication, but for some it is. And they get their lives back, they get their jobs back, they get their, functioning, their base level of functioning back, and are able to go on to get educated, go on to get, they're paying taxes, they're being a productive member of society. There's some folks that maybe have different aspects that they come to the addiction table with. Maybe they've had a lot of injuries or a lot of mental health things come up for them. They might be the person that struggles with a higher level of functioning, but still are able to take this medication and function pretty well.
We found out in other sections of this program that a lot of it has to do, a lot of people who are on substances did deal with a lot of pain, and they were prescribed pain medication, and
yeah.
Then that was taken away from them, and they still had pain, or at least in their mind they had the pain, and that's when they went out and found the other substance on the street to try to take care of the pain. That a big problem still?
I would say that is for some folks. I mean, it depends on what you have going on in your life. If somebody, had an accident on the job, I think I talked about this last time we were on the radio, have an accident on the job, you get prescribed some opiates, or have a mm-hmm. sport injury or something like that, you get prescribed opiates, the brain within a couple of weeks becomes dependent on that substance. Now, if somebody has a sports injury and they, have a good family life and they have things that they're interested in doing and positive things going on in their life, chances are that's not going to affect them. People who have maybe some other aspects of their life where they have a lot of relationship pain, or they have maybe they've lost that position to be able to be in that sport or
right.
at that job,
mm-hmm.
Then there's that's kind of a pain. I mean, a source of pain for them,
exactly.
And it plays into that and can cause people to use the substance to mask that pain
and
to deal with that pain.
And you're not talking about the physical pain, you're talking about a mental pain.
Right, right.
Yeah.
A change of life circumstances that somehow when they take those opiates, that feels, their life feels better to them.
The brain.
Yeah, the brain's like, this is what I need.
Yeah, it tricking
this
you
is
into
my
it.
Way of coping. Yeah, it becomes a coping mechanism and very highly addictive one.
We got to figure out how to change the brain on that, huh?
Yeah, well, the brain gets changed. Yeah, the brain does go through its changes from opiates, and it can do permanent damage. And so that's why some of these, medications that are offered to help people with long-term craving are so successful.
Now, treatment of substance abuse. You can say, hey, I have a problem. I need help. I need to get into a program. And there are other people who, interventions, or maybe they are in trouble with the courts.
Mm-hmm.
Forced treatment versus self-referral.
So I'll just talk about my own personal, professional experience and what I've observed over time.
Mm-hmm.
When someone, first of all, it's a rare occasion for someone who is actually fully addicted to a substance to come through the door saying, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired and I need help. But
really?
When they do, because it does happen, but when they do, they are, it seems at the front that they are ready to go. They want to deal with it. They want to get in group. They want to do some individual work. They want to get this worked out. So they show up for group, and they show up with, you know, 90% of the people there that are being either referred by the court system, by family system, by however they get there. They're not necessarily volunteering. Mm-hmm. Okay, they're there because they've been told that you're going to do this, or this is what's
going to
happen.
Right, you're going to jail.
So yeah, so they're here. They're here being forced, for lack of a better term. So you get into those group situations, and you have this one person that has been, you know, said, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired, and they're there, and they're listening to these other folks that are being forced to be in a group situation, and these folks are still very much caught up in blaming this outside source that has brought them to this situation.
Oh.
And so our job inside of that group context is to bring those people to be able to take responsibility for the fact that they are there now and not focus on. So they come with an external locus of focus, and the other person is focused on, you know, more internally what's happening with them. And so when the folks that are voluntarily there start listening to these other people that are still blaming and pointing the finger at all these agencies and these, you know, correctional systems, they get discouraged. And they tell themselves, what am I doing here? You know, what in the world am I doing here? I don't have any of that going on in my life.
I don't belong
with these people. And so they start making judgments in their own mind about how they're not there. They don't have to deal with any of that stuff. And those people are very highly susceptible to returning to their use because they're making judgments about people who are being forced to be to treatment, and they're taking it in as like, well, I don't have that problem. So I don't have a problem. So then they decide they don't have a problem. And then they're really susceptible to going back to their use. They leave group, say, I don't need this. I'll go do this on my own. And when we try to do this on our own, this disease is very isolating. We'll isolate ourselves. We'll act like we don't have a problem. And all the while, the problem's kicking up again.
Self-referral. I would have always assumed that self-referral and getting into a group like that, you would be better adapted to enjoy the group and learn from it, but you're saying
that hasn't been the case.
That's not the case.
Yeah.
So what you need to someone to put you in there?
Well,
I mean, into a treatment program. I mean, do you have to be forced into a treatment program?
I guess my message in that is that the folks that are being forced have a better chance a lot of times of sticking than those who are self-referrals.
But isn't it
denial? It's denial.
Yeah. Well, isn't it that? I mean, if you're doing a self-referral, isn't it that okay? I realize I have a problem. I got to take care of this problem.
Right.
And that doesn't bode for better success then, huh?
Well, you start digging into some of the symptoms of the disease, like the criminal problems, the CPS problems, and you start listening to the folks talking in the group, and then, like I said, they tell themselves, well, I don't have any of that going on. So then they forget to focus on the fact that they had some symptoms, you know. So we do try to incorporate in group talking about internal things that people actually see, and then external things that are really just symptoms that are, you know, our whole job is to get folks that are required to be there to get to where they want to be there, or, you know,
right,
through motivational interviewing, through CBT, through DBT, through these different modalities of treatment and the group process. And a lot of times there'll be one or two people that are in the group that are a little bit further into their recovery that, you know, the folks in that group will really listen to them because they'll start getting really real about what's going on with them. And those are usually the most effective people in a group, not even the chemical dependency or the SUDP, the substance use disorder professional, you know. You facilitate while this group does their own work a lot of times.
Right.
Yeah.
And someone who's further along in their recovery sometimes is a better influence on the people than you running the group.
Right. You know, I'm just a professional there. That's, you know, who is she?
Who's she, man?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I can understand people in a group thinking that.
Because they can relate to one another. You know, their things are real current, and it's happening right now. And so when somebody really has taken a lot of initiative to turn that responsibility dial back on themselves, and they're talking about that in group, it's powerful for the rest of the group.
Now, you were talking about how forced treatment at the beginning they are blaming anybody and everybody for them being there. Is there a point where they turn that around and think that, oh, well, maybe this is helping me?
That's our hope. That's why we do treatment.
Right.
You know, that's why we do treatment. We hope that we can inspire that within them to be able to, you know, look at themselves. You know, yes, you're going to be. Yes, we have to send compliance reports out once a month to this and such place. However, you just do what you need to do. What's right in front of you, and you don't even have to worry about those reports. Those reports will go out, and you don't even have to know about it. They're going to be great. You just keep doing what you need to do for you.
You keep showing up at the meetings and
suiting up, doing the work that's put before you, and you don't even have to worry about who we're reporting to.
Now, also in the forest treatment, how many of them are, how do I want to put this? They're there to fulfill the obligation that they have to either the family or to the courts or whoever got them into the program. And then they're thinking, okay, I got 6 weeks of this, or I got 3 months of this, or I don't know how long it would be.
Right.
But when I'm done, I'm done, and I'm going to go back to the street.
Well, hopefully, as a professional, I'm watching for that. You know, I'm observing that. And when I have individual time with them, I bring that up, you know, that I'm observing that I see some resistance that, you know, and let's talk about that. Let's get into that resistance. There's always some resistance because denial is, you know, the hallmark symptom of the disease.
Well, yeah, I don't have a problem to begin with.
Right.
Right.
I'm only here because they told me I had to come here.
Right, yeah, I don't have a problem. Right. The judge says, you know, you got to show up for this.
So then, you know, you can basically say, well, what is the problem that other people see, you know, and you get them to look at that. Well, this is what they see. Well, how much of that do you see for yourself? You know, there's ways of going about that, being able to have that conversation.
It was several years ago, many years ago, in fact, that you first started hearing about interventions and the such in regards to substance abuse, whether it be alcohol or drugs.
Right.
And the family would get together, or family and friends would get together and have an intervention. Is that a powerful way to get a person to turn their life around? I mean, when their family and friends say, you got a problem? Or is their addiction so bad that they're sitting there saying to themselves, well, these people don't know what they're talking about. I don't have a problem.
Well, I think as far as interventions go, even that's changed over time. There used to be, you know, the surprise model, the Johnson model, where someone would come in as an interventionist and do a little bit of work with the family concerned, and then go in, and it would be a complete and total shock to the person who is being intervened on.
Right, that's the kind that I've heard about. Yeah. But that's changed
and,
a little bit.
Well, they've got many ways of intervening now. There's the invitational model, the family systems model. There's different ways to go about involving family and then inviting that person that you want to do the intervention on, inviting them to the process.
Ah.
And part of that inviting them to the process is you've had a pre-conversation with the family where you've talked to them about what are you willing to do? Because, you know, there's a lot of enabling and codependency that goes on within family systems. And so if you can get a family to be able to look at their part in it, you know, maybe they're not drinking and they're not using, but they've, you know, been covering for this person and covering different aspects of their life. If you can get them to look at their need for help and then invite this person that they want to intervene on into it, and you're talking to them about how, hey, this is what I'm going to do as a result of, I need to go to Al-Anon or I need to go to Nar-Anon, or, you know, if they'll engage in their own process, and this person is being invited into that process, chances are that you're going to be more successful with that because the family is actually willing to look at their own part in the family disease.
And it does break down to that, too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Each person is affected.
In the family, and sometimes A or some members of a family may be the reason that the person got addicted in the first place.
Right.
Because of their addiction, maybe. And maybe it isn't. Maybe you have a heroin addict that you're trying to intervene with, but the person doing the intervening is an alcoholic or something.
Right.
Then the person who you're trying to intervene will sit there and say, well, but hold it, Reese. You drink every night.
Yeah.
Why can't I shoot up?
And we have those conversations before we ever really talk with the person that we're intervening with because, that person, I mean, you know, the interventionist's job is to ask those people, the folks that want to be supportive, you know, what is your use? You know, what do you use?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what kind of behaviors do you have that are contributing to this? So that when that, because the addict or the alcoholic will point it out with when they're approached. They'll be going, what about you? What about your drinking? What about your shopping addiction? What about your, you know, compulsive overeating? I mean, they'll point, addicts do that. They'll point at, you know, other people's problems. They get, so they can get the focus off of themselves, deflecting, you know. And so each person needs to give, needs to be prepared to speak to that.
And we're talking even as simple as someone addicted to nicotine and smoking cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
I'll full transparency, I'm a smoker.
Mm-hmm.
I'm addicted to nicotine. I have been for decades.
Okay.
So if I have a family member that, thank God I don't, is having a problem, would they look at me and say, well, Reese, you've been smoking cigarettes for 30 years or 40 years or whatever, and why do you think you're better than me?
Yeah, and you might be able to say to that, you know, that you're right. I've been smoking for a long time, and maybe I need to take a look at that. But right now, today, we're here because we care about you, and we're seeing, and then you have the opportunity to give your observations lovingly mm-hmm. and respectfully to the person that you're intervening on.
By the way, my doctor is working hard on getting me off, so just to let people out there know, you know.
Well, there are medication assisted treatments for that too. The patch.
That's what he said. I have another appointment with him here in about 3 weeks.
Well,
so
good for you.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. But he set a deadline. Okay, we're gonna do it then. We'll see.
Yeah. Harm reduction,
and,
you know, being able to use nicotine patch or nicotine lozenges,
right,
you know, you're not
you
inhaling the smoke, so there's some reduction in harm with using those methods for tapering off nicotine.
Join us next Monday morning at 8:40 a.m. for our continuing discussion on substance use disorder as a treatable disease, brought to you by the Grays Harbor Consortium, exclusively on 103.5 FM and 1450 a.m. KBKW. To hear archived discussions, log on to gograysharbor.com.